You know, John worked 30 years at Platts. He's now the president of McGraw-Hill's Financial Global Institute. I asked John to come here and talk about what's going to happen with oil prices. Has it hit bottom? How big is the bounce is going to be and when? And he's promised me that he will provide all of that. But I also promised him I wouldn't hold him to any of it. Having spent 30 years at Platts studying these issues, John speaks frequently on what the trends are in oil markets, and I'm very pleased to have John Kingston join us this morning. Please join me in welcoming John Kingston.
I have just left Platts after about 29 and a half years. So just went downtown to another position at McGraw-Hill. And the irony is that I always wanted to come to the RFA meeting for years, and it always conflicted with a big event in London. So here I finally got to the meeting, but I'm no longer with Platts. But I do appreciate Bob and the RFA's request to have us here. So I'm representing, yes, the McGraw-Hill Financial Global Institute, of which I am now president, but also I continue to represent Platts. So, yes, it's been some interesting times. As you know, as the Chinese say, may you live in interesting times, and we certainly have had that. So let's take a look at some of the things that are going on. We'll go right to the latest IEA oil market report, because I think that's really kind of the benchmark. Everybody criticizes it, but nobody really has any better suggestion for looking at supply-demand figures. I think the most interesting thing to look at when you look at that graph is the OPEC call. You know, if you've ever seen a full IEA oil market report, there's a lot in there. There's data and tables and words. You could be in it for hours. But if you only had 30 seconds to look at it, what you'd want to look at is the OPEC call. And the OPEC call is actually very simple. You estimate world demand, and then you take away estimated non-OPEC supply. You take away estimated OPEC NGL supply, and what you have left is the OPEC call, which is the amount of oil that OPEC would need to produce to keep markets in perfect balance. So what's interesting here is when you look at this table, you see what the OPEC call numbers have done recently. So the way to read this is that the row at the top, September, is what was the IEA's estimated OPEC call back in September in their September report, then the December report, and then the February report, which just came out last week. So you can see what's happened. Their call for the first quarter of 2015 was 28.9, then it dropped down to 28.6, and then it kind of moved back up to 28.7. But let's actually look at the fourth quarter. Back last fall, before everything collapsed, the estimate on the call was 30.1, dropped all the way down to 29.3. That's 800,000 barrels a day. And now with their estimate of a slowdown in non-OPEC production, primarily coming out of the U.S., that call is back up to 30.2, which is actually higher than it was September. So those numbers are starting to reflect the IEA's projection that you're going to get a significant downturn in U.S. Other parts of the world, but particularly U.S. oil production. So we have that number, and then I read through Platts this week, and I see two stories that really caught my eye. One of them was the report on the quarterly earnings call of EOG Resources, which is one of the biggest producers up in the Bakken. And what the CEO of that company said is, we've got an inventory of about 200 wells that we've drilled, but that we have not yet finished. And those can be actually completed very quickly. So that's almost like, you know, you get the report every week of what the EIA says is oil in inventory, and then really those wells that are drilled but not yet completed are almost like a whole nother source of inventory because they can be turned into production very quickly. So I cite EOG because it's very fresh. It just came out of the last day or two. They're one of the biggest producers, but they're not alone. There are a lot of oil producers out there that have drilled wells, have not completed them, and they're getting ready to go whenever the price rises. And the head of EOG said, well, you know what? I think we're going to maybe complete these wells and produce from them when the price gets all the way up to $60. Okay, so that's not that far away. So you can see kind of the frustration that the Saudis might have when they see numbers like that. But still, I don't want to undercut these numbers here. It does show that the big oil market projection shows the complete supply-demand imbalance that we have now might be eased up a little bit by the fourth quarter of the year. 30.2, if that in fact is the call in the fourth quarter, that's about where OPEC is producing now. So you're back to balance. The other thing that the that the IEA reports have shown is a significant upturn in their demand projections. The demand is projected to rise about 900,000 barrels a day this year, and that's certainly not up to the level of, let's say, 1.2, 1.3 that we were running just a few years ago, but still recently some of those projections for annual demand growth have been down around, let's say, the 700,000 barrel a day level, and maybe even less. The whisper number might have been less than that. So you can see that there actually is a demand response to the lower price. How much of it is a response to the lower price? How much of it is just economic growth in the U.S.? And how much of that is just a chicken and egg discussion? The inventory numbers, they do global inventories as opposed to the weekly EIA numbers that everybody looks at. In the most recent report, they looked at the end of November numbers, and they were up to 65 million barrels a day from 16 back in November. So that's a huge gap, and global inventories are rising, even as U.S. inventories, of course, are continuing to rise as well. Now you have Citi. I don't know how many of you know Ed Morris. Ed Morris is a longtime oil market observer. He's done about everything in the industry, and right now he and his team of commodity analysts are the ultimate bears. They came out with one of their, I don't know if you want to call it apocalyptic. I guess it's an apocalyptic report if you actually produce this stuff. If you buy it, it's actually great news. But they came out with a report this week, or maybe it was last week, in which they said it is entirely possible over the next few months to see a price of oil that might be in the 20s. Now, remember, we're at about $50 now, so that's like another $20 plus to go. Their view is that things will straighten out. As you see that on the right, that quote from the report, $50 or $60, even $60 barrel oil is not sustainable. But in the short term, when you look at the supply-demand imbalance, when you look at the OPEC call, when you look at what OPEC is producing relative to the call, which is a gap of 400,000 to 500,000 barrels a day, if not more, you can see that it's going to take quite some time to get this surplus out of the market. Just as a side, Citi estimated where the new sources of supply this year are from, and no surprise, Canada, U.S. is U.S. is quite a bit. And I realize now that those numbers don't add up to 100, do they? Okay, well, I'll have to speak to the team that puts together my report. But so just look at the bars, and you can get some sense of magnitude. Now, the rig count has gotten a lot of attention from the general media, and it's understandable, but the rig count has become a very imperfect barometer in recent years. You look at this number. Several years ago, the EIA started coming out with a well productivity report. It's a very, very good number. What this number on the left is the rig count in the Bakken. And you can see where, you go back a few years ago and it actually had already started to flatten out. But did that affect production? No. That's because the production per rig, you can see on the right, is up substantially. And it continues to rise as new technology, as human ingenuity is brought to this process. And if you looked at the chart, you would see the same kind of thing for the Permian, and you would see the same kind of thing for the Eagle Ford. And that's why, this time it's different. Because in the past, when you had booms and busts, and being at Platts a long time, I've seen some booms and busts, you would have some technological development when prices were really high that would maybe impact supply, but nothing like the kind of technological development that has broken through in the shale. As a result of that, there's been all sorts of analogies of what shale production is like. My favorite is the factory floor. Goldman Sachs had a video this week in which they talked about it like making paper clips. Another colleague of mine down at Standard & Poor's has another analogy. I forget what he calls. But the whole point is that you can bring this stuff on pretty quickly. Of course, the success rates in the shale are north of 90%. You can actually shut the well down and then bring it back very quickly. And this is the dilemma that the Saudis and others are facing as they try to drive the price of oil higher. If they do, in fact, drive the price of oil higher, to bring this oil back on that might start to be cut back, that can come back on very, very quickly. It's nowhere near like the lead times that you might have seen back in 1986 and 1998, 1999, these other periods of crude oil price collapse. So, they always say it's different this time. Sometimes it isn't, but I think in the world of oil, almost everybody agrees that the combination of geology plus technology certainly does make it different this time. So where's the excess oil going? And there certainly is excess. Well, it's going into storage. The number on the left is actually a little bit out of date. It's the total stocks. That shouldn't say average monthly. Those are just total stocks, and they actually ticked higher in the most recent report. They are probably at a record, if not. So the WTI curve between March and out to next February, a 12-month curve, you see that on the right. And what essentially that does is it creates an incentive to store. With storage costs about 50 cents, maybe a little more. I saw one estimate about 75 cents a barrel. You can play the curve. You can buy the oil now. You can store it out in the future. And so essentially what you've done is you've taken today's glut and you've shoved it off, you know, 10, 11, 12 months, maybe further, which means that any kind of recovery is going to be quite a long way off, because as a result of that, you essentially have guaranteed your supply all the way out for 12 months or more. So the curve is guaranteeing that it's going to take quite some time to work this surplus off, because let's say the demand for February 2016, the demand that's going to take you to your next meeting, where's next year's meeting?
New Orleans.
New Orleans, okay, has already been spoken for to some degree. So that shows you the difficulty that the market has in pulling out of this spin. So what's the demand response? You know, this is particularly important to this group because obviously the more gasoline that's consumed in the U.S., issues with the blend wall tend to go away. There's just a more outright demand for ethanol. This is not a great graph, but I think if you look at the kind of, the gray line, you see a year ago, even before prices had started to drop, demand for gasoline was significantly above the year before. And you see by the end of the year, when the demand response from a price drop would have been more visible, it was significantly above the prior year. Now, the numbers this year have already been very weak, but that's to be understood because you've got horrible weather in the Northeast, which is a major population center. Of course, last winter wasn't too great either. But I think that little red line heading down is an aberration that you'll start to see go up. There's all sorts of anecdotes about increased gasoline demand. But at the same time, there's all sorts of anecdotes about people not necessarily driving anymore, but just saving the savings, putting their surplus cash into savings. The fact of the matter is that some of these demand responses do take time. You know, you look over these monthly figures, the monthly auto sales figures, and you see the Chevy Suburbans. They're all doing very well. And meanwhile, some of the smaller cars are not doing as well. I personally would not want to be the brand manager for the Chevy Cruze or the Chevy Volt right now. I think my job would be rather difficult. But I think you're almost certainly going to see a continued demand response to these lower prices. We always have in the past. Sometimes it doesn't happen right away, but it does happen. I want to go back because I think I missed something. Yeah, as far as demand estimates, I mentioned earlier that the estimated demand growth in 2015, according to the IEA, was about 900,000 barrels a day. The IEA has not yet come out with its estimate for 2016, but Citi has, and their estimate is that production year on year in 2015 will be up 1.3 million barrels a day, but a little less than that in 2016. So Citi, in some sense, Citi is very bearish on the price, but very bullish on demand. So they see a significantly higher rate of growth than the IEA does for all of this year, and a little less than that next year. So again, you see a demand response, no doubt about it. So what has the shale boom meant for the U.S.? The EIA comes out with a monthly statistical report. It comes out at the end of usually the last week of the month, and it's for the prior, I guess it's complete through 2 months earlier, or is it 3 months? I can't remember, but there's a lot of data in there. But the number that I always like to go to, the first number I go to are net imports, total net imports. And total net imports in the U.S. peaked out around August 2005 in excess of 13 million barrels a day, and they're now below 5 million barrels a day. So I just want you to think about that. You know, you wonder why the dollar is so strong. Well, you know, back from on an almost 10-year spread, we're sending 8 million barrels a day less worth of dollars abroad, and we're keeping it home. Then I think the other figure that I like to do is I like to take the U.S. net import number, and then I subtract out Canada. Because certainly Canada does have some ability to export its crude oil and its products. Certainly it can export its products out of its East Coast refineries. But, you know, the advantages of selling into the U.S. are so great that I tend to think of that as almost just one big North American market. So if you took out the Canadian number on that, that's the lower line. And so you're talking about U.S. net import dependence of about 2 million barrels a day net of Canada. That is a staggering number. I mean, when you think about it, 2 million barrels a day, and meanwhile, the U.S. Navy is still protecting the Persian Gulf. And so the politics of that get very interesting. Essentially, the U.S. Navy is putting aircraft carriers into the Persian Gulf to protect supplies of oil that go to China. Now, I realize that geopolitically, oil is for everybody. The price of oil would affect everybody. But if you've got net imports of just 2 million barrels a day, if you take out your neighbor to the north, who obviously is your friend, the geopolitics of that are significant. The other number I like to look at is the number of days in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The IEA's statutory requirement on how many days of stocks you need to hold is about 90 days, and the U.S. is up to about 150 days, and that's including Canada. So the U.S. really has too much oil in the SPR relative to its needs. And you're not going to do this now because the price of oil was pretty high. It's pretty low now. But when the price of oil was a lot higher and Vladimir Putin was, you know, starting to play around in Ukraine and other places, there was one argument, mostly put forth by economist Phil Verlager, who many of you know, that the U.S. should start to sell the SPR. And maybe not in one big chunk, but maybe just a daily offering. You know, every day there's, let's say, a two-minute window in which you would come and bid for SPR oil, and the U.S. could simply say, well, you know, we're doing this because we really have too much oil in the tank. We don't need this much given our net import dependence. Didn't happen. Would have certainly been interesting, and I don't think that's going to happen now when the price of WTI is at $50. But it's something to consider that, quite frankly, the SPR is way, way overfunded. Do you, at a certain point, start to use that as a strategic tool? Any talk of using it is gone because the market took care of that being that strategic tool. But keep in mind that it's there. And I think the SPR stocks account for about 60% of total U.S. crude stocks. So it's a lot of oil. As a result of all this, the U.S. has become a significant export powerhouse. The amount of products that the U.S. exports totally dwarfs out of Rotterdam, dwarfs out of Singapore, which are, you know, the world's other really big export points. You look at what capacity has done. Now, this is also with blender input, so some of the figures that your organization has will be in there. But, you know, capacity hasn't risen that much. But yet we're supplying more products and we're exporting more. These refineries are becoming very efficient. They're operating at a very strong rate. Ethanol is being blended at a 900,000 barrel a day rate. So the U.S., it's not just become an energy superpower in terms of production of gas and production of oil and production of NGLs, but it's most certainly become an export powerhouse in terms of its refineries and as an exporter of refined products. So what does this mean for gasoline? What I've done here is I've taken, gasoline as a percentage of LLS. I've taken the price of Gulf Coast gasoline and I laid it against LLS and just did it as a percentage and seen how it fluctuates. And what's sort of interesting is that ultimately it all sort of comes back to a norm. It obviously took a very big dip there early last year, but then you see it start to rise. And over time, it does remain fairly steady. And I engaged in this exercise because the shale boom has made me wonder, you know, what relationships are permanently altered. Obviously, the relationship between the price of North American natural gas, and when I say North America, you know, Mexico is benefiting from that as well. The price of North American natural gas and crude oil has permanently, as permanent as anything is, but has permanently split. I wanted to see what else has split. So I looked at gasoline because, you know, we heard a couple of years ago gasoline was the big dog of the market. Nobody was going to want to make gasoline. Ethanol had taken a good chunk of its market. And when I look at this, you know, this goes back over, you know, the last 2 years. I don't see anything that indicates that. To me, that looks fairly healthy. So then I was also wondering about propane because propane supplies in the U.S. have soared as a result of all the gas production and all the associated liquids production. And when I look at the price of propane to LLS, that relationship, yes, it's moved around quite a bit, But, you know, ultimately it comes back toward a little bit of a norm. And naphtha as well, because ethane has displaced so much naphtha in the petrochemical industry in the U.S., I was wondering, well, has naphtha found a new low, kind of a new permanent low? And what's happened is that around the world, the markets have found new ways to use naphtha. Maybe there's since there's less and less imports coming into the U.S., the reformers are operating in the rest of the world. And so these markets are incredibly flexible and very, very creative in finding ways to deal with excesses. Now, ethanol is a little bit more difficult because the price of ethanol, the market for ethanol obviously has a very big government role in it. And when you bring a government into a market, it tends not to operate the way it might have otherwise. So let's face it. I mean, ethanol probably should be below gasoline all the time because it's lower energy content. But you see some periods where it's not. Then you also, of course, have the fact that when you look at the petroleum complex, it all comes from the same feedstock. And ethanol comes from a different feedstock in a different market. So you see that volatility there. It's, you know, it's quite substantial. And I'm reminded of the market for onions. Back in the late 50s or late 60s, the U.S. government actually put a ban on commodity trading in onions. And it was pushed by Gerald Ford. I don't know if there's anybody here from the Grand Rapids area where their onions are grown in large degree in Grand Rapids. I don't know. But I've seen the chart for onion prices, and you'd think, right, there's no commodity trading. It should be nice and calm, right, nice and steady. Forget it. It was one of the most volatile markets out there. So anytime you introduce a government mandate or a government role in a market, they tend to get a little more volatile because they're reacting to not just the incentives of the market, but they're reacting to the incentives, or not just the incentives, but the mandates created by the government. So, you know, I think ethanol will probably always be a little more volatile compared to some of these other petroleum-based products, which always do tend to find their norm. The impact of the Brent WTI movement, you know, it was 27, it got back to flat, and then, now it's blown out to 9 or 10. And the question was, how is this going to affect refineries in PADD 1? Because they were the ones that, when it was 27, that were getting killed because they could not compete with other U.S. refineries that were able to operate on lower crude oil, the cheaper Midwest crude oil. So, of course, the creative solution to that was that they went out and they found all sorts of rail supplies, and they built themselves back up into a nice operating rate. So even as the Brent WTI spread came down, you see, like, toward the latter part of that, you know, you can see some of these big dips, like in 2012. You know, that's when the Brent WTI spread was at its widest. That's when the East Coast refineries were really getting hit. But you look in the last year, you know, they've operated at a pretty nice level. So I'm assuming this is important to your group because the more refineries, the more domestic supply, maybe a little better market for you. But the East Coast refiners, with the help of rail, have managed to find a way to keep operating despite that much narrower Brent WTI spread. So let's talk about a couple of key questions for the future, because I have 5 minutes, as this big screen tells me. What does this transformative technology mean as the new normal? It wasn't all that long ago when everybody said $100 a barrel is the new normal. I don't know that too many people would say that. Of course, what's your time frame? Someday it'll probably be $100 again. But, you know, what's your time frame for the next year or two? Well, you've already taken, as I mentioned, a lot of the surplus from today, and you've shoved it out to meet consumption that isn't even there yet 12 months from now. So that makes it very difficult for the market to recover. How much of a spur to demand does this new price create? I think it's probably pretty significant. I would look at those U.S. gasoline numbers pretty closely. But remember, always look at U.S. diesel numbers, too, because diesel, really more than gasoline, diesel is the fuel of industrial activity. Gasoline has a lot of social aspects to it. You know, those of you who grew up in the 50s or 60s and 70s when cars were at the center of our lives, who maybe now have teenagers or young adults now, they can tell you they're not as obsessed with cars as they used to be. That's always said to be a factor. So I would look at diesel demand as a pretty good barometer for overall demand for oil. How else can the U.S. flex its refining superpower status? If the U.S. does get into a jam where, because of export restrictions, it does start to develop yet again a glut of oil that there's nothing to do with, maybe you start to see additional refining capacity built in the U.S. as people say, all right, well, let's go ahead and just, we'll just export this stuff as products. Of course, logically, it doesn't make much sense. But the thing that could always slow down a decision like that would be, well, what if the export ban is somehow lifted someday, and then we've got all this sunk costs into refining capacity that we don't need? And this is, I think, one of the things that's slowing down the construction of condensate splitters. You know, a condensate splitter takes all the excess condensate that's coming from the very light crude oil supplies that we've got much of, and it turns it into a naphtha and LPG blend. And there should be, logically, a lot of investment in it. They're not enormous facilities. But if you can just export the condensate, well, why don't you just do that? So you can see where these government regulations are kind of slowing and making the decision-making process a little more confusing. And then, you know, what other spreads find new norms, if any? I don't know. Which ones snap back to the old ones? It's hard to imagine that the relationship between North American natural gas and crude oil is ever going to be restored. I think that's probably important for this industry, because I'm assuming that a lot of your ethanol plants are being fueled by cheaper natural gas, and that's been a real benefit to any really industrial process in the U.S. And do some of these things drop to a new level, and how does that impact on ethanol? I really don't know. It's difficult enough to figure out what's going to happen with things like naphtha and propane. The U.S. has become a major exporter of propane as a result of these gluts, and I think the final message is that industries always do tend to find a way around these problems. It's a very creative industry. Looking at the Keystone XL pipeline, I was sat in on a presentation once about possible solutions, and one solution was to build a pipeline from the oil sands over to Lake Superior, and then put the oil on ships and move them around the Great Lakes like they do iron ore out of Minnesota. And I thought, just wow, this industry will not stop. So you can have something like Keystone XL stopped. You can have some out-of-date export ban in place, and the industry will find a way around these rules. So it's a very creative industry, but it's obviously a creative industry at a much lower price. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.